Hello, everyone. I'm Kevin Gastola, managing editor of Shadowproof.com. I'm joined by Rob Call, who is the journalist, publisher, and founder of OpEdNews.com. He's known for giving talks and workshops on psychology, brain science, and story. He's also the host of the Bottom Up radio show, and he's the author of the new book, The Bottom Up Revolution, Mastering the Emerging World of Connectivity. And he's a good friend of mine. So welcome, Rob.
Thanks so much for having me, Kev.
And should just preface our conversation by saying that a lot of my ability to emerge as a journalist was a credit to opednews.com because of the exposure that work I was doing was able to get. So I think that's part of what we'll be getting to here with Bottom Up, this, you know, this ability for things to change in such a way that people who were in lower rungs and didn't have these platforms that functioned in a top-down way were able to get noticed, at least in the last 10 to 15 years. I really see Op-Ed News as being part of the bottom-up revolution that you talk about. But let's begin first very basically by having you outline what you mean by bottom-up and what you mean by bottom-up revolution when you talk about this concept.
Sure. Well, the first thing is, what was a big surprise for me was what bottom-up was, and the realization that most people think of bottom-up in terms of grassroots and wisdom of the crowd and crowdfunding and maybe the comments on Amazon or Yelp. But it's way more than that. And I discovered that in my bottom-up journey. And my bottom-up journey started with Op-Ed News. I decided at Op-Ed News that I was going to let the users, I shouldn't say let, I was inviting the users and the writers and the volunteer editors to have a big say in how policies were made and how decisions were made. And I saw that as a bottom-up approach. And that worked. The site really took off. So it started seeing 200, even 800,000 unique visitors a month. And that got me really fascinated with what is bottom up. And early on, I had a conversation with Joe Trippi, who ran the first nationwide internet campaign for Howard Dean. And he, at that time, back around 2008, when I started thinking about it, observed that Hillary Clinton had the most powerful top-down campaign for president ever, and she was going to lose to a bottom-up campaign from Barack Obama. So I started this radio show, Bottom Up Radio, and over the years I've interviewed over 450 people, and I learned a lot, and it gave me some really different ways of thinking about bottom-up. So but by the way, the best place to find out about Bottom Up is my website, robcall.com, R-O-B-K-A-L-L.com. And there, if you go to the book tab, you have an option to buy it on Amazon, which will help my ratings. Or if you don't like Amazon, you can buy it at independent bookstores or PALs or a whole bunch of different other options that are there. But one of the things I learned that really kind of blew my mind was from a psychologist, Darsha Narvaez, who is at Notre Dame. She wrote a book called The Neurobiology of the Development of Human Morality. And what I basically took away from it, from reading the book and then interviewing her a couple times, was that humans evolved to be moral beings that were incredibly bottom up. And that evolution process took about 7 million years. So in that time, we developed literally hundreds of genes that potentiate us to be bottom up. Now, what does that mean? People before civilization, which was 99% of the times that humans have existed, lived in hunter-gatherer bands of 30 to 80 people, not even tribes. And everybody had to take care of each other. Babies didn't cry because there was a whole band of people to keep them happy and nurtured. And people had to be conscious of how their behavior affected everybody else because their lives depended on it. Not just how their behavior affected everybody else, but how it affected nature. You couldn't just dump something and let it go into a stream because it could poison people and it could hurt the environment, and people lived off of that environment. So people were incredibly cooperative, incredibly interdependent, and they had what I call connection consciousness. They were aware of how everything they did was connected to everything else. So that's one element of it. Civilization came along then, and civilization does wonderful things. It gives us big roads and huge projects, but it also gave us centralization and hierarchy and domination and slavery, and it repressed a lot of our bottom-up natures as we went into cities and what have you. Now, civilization, the earliest civilization was 10,000 years ago, but an awful lot of humanity didn't get exposed to civilization until 500 years ago. It's not that new. I mean, it's not that old, civilization. So you've got humans with these hundreds of genes, many of them repressed. And then along comes smartphones and the web, and they produce a bottom-up kind of a mind. And that helped to reactivate or catalyze all these genes that we have that are bottom up. Now, part of the book, a lot of the book is about activism and revolution. There's a whole chapter on revolution, but it's also, it looks at the business world too. And that's because I think it's very exciting. I think the idea that trillions of dollars in new business have been created and trillions of dollars of businesses have been destroyed because of bottom-up changes is pretty interesting. And I think that the book gives a lot of hope. The book has over 50 endorsements, and a lot of them, I was pleased to see, talk about how hopeful the book is. And part of it, I think, is because bottom up is a concept that can bring about change. You know, we saw it with the Arab Spring. But you know, another one of my discoveries with bottom up was through an interview I did with Fritjof Capra. Actually, I read his book, The Systems View of Life, and I discovered that there's a lot of bottom up thinking in the new science. For hundreds of years, science was linear, and it was based on Descartes and Cartesian thinking and Newton. But that model of science, this mechanistic, take things apart and figure out how to make it work and what makes it work, didn't work for subatomic particle theory, and it didn't work for complex systems theories like ecosystems. So they had to come up with a new kind of science, and they called it systems theory or the systems model or chaos theory or nonlinear dynamic theory. And this model is what is the current model of science now. And the difference is the old linear model looks at things in a straight line, and it takes things apart, and it looks how one step happens after another. The modern view, the new science, the nonlinear systems approach, looks at relationships and patterns, and it looks at cycles. And that's a huge difference, because what can happen in systems theory is that as things change, there are new emergent processes and patterns. And emergence is a fascinating concept. And what's really exciting about it is that a new emergent process or pattern can pop up and become dominant in a very short amount of time. Now, that's compared to the linear idea that you have to have this growth that takes place that requires a majority or 50% plus one. In the nonlinear way that change happens, it can explode and it can happen really suddenly. So what I love about that is that this, if you think about change that way, then it can happen very, very quickly. And to me, that's very hopeful. And the idea of emergence in politics is something that I think is really cool. And I think we've seen it with, let's say, Ocasio-Cortez. She has exploded on the scene. And all of a sudden, she's got a huge voice, and at a national level. And that's, I think, pretty incredible. I've been talking a long time. You got a question or anything?
Well, I think related to that, you're right. Yep. We have seen a proliferation of these sort of smaller groups, like the Justice Democrats, like Our Revolution, which have facilitated and helped candidates. There's also National People's Action, so you're helping people to emerge as you talk about. So I want to connect back to some of the psychology. I want to have you talk about some of the psychology that you get into in your book, which is you break down the differences between a bottom-up mind versus a top-down mind. And can you talk about that? And I don't know if you want to take it a step further and maybe address how you feel some of the shifts in the last 10 to 15 years have affected people with top-down minds. Is it disruptive? Does it make them struggle to exist within the changing landscape?
I think that what happened is, you know, people born after 1980 have different brains. Their brains work differently. And I've checked this out with many neuroscientists, and they all agree. People see the world and they interact with the world differently. Those people born after 1980 grew up texting multiple people simultaneously. They grew up with the internet, and it makes them see the world differently. They are open to a different way of interacting, and they expect things to be done in a different way. It's a challenge for people born before 1980. They have to learn how to adapt to it. And people born after 1980 have to have an understanding that people born before 1980 have these more top-down minds. You know, top-down is the opposite of bottom-up. And top-down minds tend to, I think, be more authoritarian. Now, I think it's really important to discuss the idea of authoritarianism in that with authoritarianism, there are a small handful of people who want to tell people what to do. They're authoritarian. But most of the authoritarians, 99.9% of them, they're people who want to be told what to do. And this, I think, is a top-down mindset that I think I'm very hopeful that people born after 1980 have less of, because they have a different kind of power. Power comes in different forms, and the old kind of power, hard power, was based on weapons and might and money and buying control and power. But there's a new kind of power, soft power, and I write about it extensively in the book. Soft power is based on attraction, and you get that power by getting people to want to have a relationship with you, to want to do what you want them to do. And that's what diplomacy is all about. And it's tragic that under Trump, the amount invested in diplomacy has been cut, and the amount spent on hard power, on military, has increased drastically. And we really need to change that. We have that power, and I think the idea of soft power is not one that people talk about generally, but I think young people, their brains, their minds, their way of seeing the world, it's got that understanding of soft power much more. Now, you know, in my book, I tell the story of the blind wise ones who are put in a room, and they are told to figure out what's in the room. And one person says it's a tree trunk. Another says it's a rug. Another says it's a cow. Another says it's a spear. Another one says it's a rope. And all these blind people are touching an elephant, and it's the leg and the side and the ear and the tail and the tusks that they're touching. And I think that bottom up is kind of like that for most people in this world today. They've experienced it, they've experienced pieces of it, but they haven't put the whole picture together. And that's what I tried to do in this book by interviewing anthropologists and psychologists, experts on power and politics and revolution. And I think that what the book offers is a big picture that lets you see the whole thing. And when you do that, you have a better ability to master and grab the power that you have. Bottom up is a kind of power. I think it's a kind of intelligence. One of the people I interviewed was Howard Gardner, who came up with the multiple intelligences theory. And I really think that bottom up mind is a kind of intelligence. It's a way of being able to connect with other people. And there's a whole chapter in the book on being smarter about connecting, developing skills for connecting with other people, for networking. You know, the internet has done wonderful and horrible things with connection, you know, because in some ways it's disconnected us, you know, and people who become addicted to screens, they disconnect from the real world, the analog world, the face-to-face world where you smell people's breath, and they're stuck on screens. So I do write a lot about how I put together a kind of an anatomy of connection, from preparing to connect more effectively with people, to how to deepen your connection when you're actually present with somebody, and how to use those connections more.
You mentioned earlier that you drew a lot of your insights from examining the cultures of indigenous people. I was wondering if you had any examples or things that really inspired your project.
Well, you know, discovering that before civilization, people were much more bottom up made me realize that indigenous people, there are still at least 250 million indigenous people on this earth now. And we have so much to learn from them. I've been to conferences, I've interviewed a number of people who are experts at it, who are indigenous themselves. And it's a different way of relating to each other and the world. For example, Native Americans have a way of thinking that when they make a decision, they want to base it on how it'll affect the next seven generations. This is part of what I call this connection consciousness, bottom-up connection consciousness. You think about how what you do affects others. Now, this is the diametric opposite of Ayn Rand's individualism. I think individualism is a narcissistic idea that is just has been taken way too far. I think that humans evolved to be connected to other people, to function cooperatively. Individualism is pathological. Yeah, you're an individual, but you don't function alone. You function with other people. And if you try to be an individual, you're being selfish and narcissistic. And I think there's way too much of that. I've asked a couple of experts. I asked an expert on psychopathy, and I've asked anthropologists, what do people in hunter-gatherer bands and tribes do with people who want half of the resources of the tribe, who demand that everything be about them? And the answer I get is, for example, somebody in Nunavut up in northern Canada, is they put them on an ice floe and push them off into the ocean, which basically means ban them or kill them. And I, you know, I've written a lot for the last 8 years about how we need to get rid of billionaires. There's too much power with too much money. And I think that indigenous people have a much clearer understanding of how to deal with sharing and cooperation and interdependence and the relationship to nature, too. I mean, if you look at indigenous people, they have a kind of a spiritual relationship to nature. And one of the things I've tried to do is adapt some of that for my own life, so that, you know, when I go out, I try to get out in nature every day. I try to go out where the trees are. And I literally look at trees and I think of them as beings and as another part of nature that I want to connect with. And the same thing with the sky, with birds. Part of what I believe is that you can develop skills by learning how to connect. And one way you do that is you prepare. You literally learn about your environment. You actually take steps to learn about the birds that are in your area, the trees that are in your area. Notice the changes that are happening week to week as the seasons go by. These are ways to connect that are bottom-up ways that where you respect nature. And by connecting with it, it opens you up, I think, to a different way of relating to both the world and to other people, too.
Well, what occurs to me from you talking about this and the idea of connection consciousness, as well as these newer generations whose brains are wired differently, is that we have this impending catastrophe coming with the climate, and yet it seems that because we've had this shift that we might be more empowered than ever to address it. Whereas if we were faced with this climate disaster a half century or a century ago, based upon our industrialization or whatever, we might still have this authoritarian mentality that would make it even more difficult. But in fact, for people who feel it's hopeless, it does seem like listening to you that we're almost in an even better position than we were 50 years ago to address climate change.
We are, but it's really, there's a battle between top down and bottom up. We do need both. You need to have leaders, but you have to have leaders who are conscious of the powers and abilities and potential of the people they're leading so that they respect them. But you've got people who are top-down powers, billionaires, heads of corporations, and they're benefiting from the top-down culture that we primarily have. I believe we're shifting to a more bottom-up one, but it's still predominantly top-down. And they're going to fight. They're going to fight really hard to keep the power that they have, to keep the wealth that they have, to keep the system and the structure that they have. And we need to change that. And we can change that, and we are changing it. And I believe that my book offers a vision of the many different ways that bottom up makes a different world. I have a list of about 25, 30 different bottom up characteristics versus top down ones. People are in bottom up, they tend to be collective, equal, horizontal rather than hierarchical. They're sharing, or they distribute power rather than dominating. There's democratization rather than authoritarianism. They're connected rather than detached with boundaries. They're cooperative and collaborative rather than competitive and consultative. They're interdependent rather than independent. The list goes on and on. And it's a list that I gradually put together by having conversations with hundreds of people in my goal and effort of trying to understand more about bottom up. Bernie Sanders has said it, so many of his talks, change doesn't happen from the top down, it happens from the bottom up. Yeah. So you want to understand bottom up in a much deeper way, because if you do, you start seeing the world more that way. It becomes a filter through which, a metaphor, a filter through which you see your world. And I think that can make a big difference. Even if people just tap a little bit more of their bottom-up-ness, their bottom-up nature, it's really going to give them the ability to tap their bottom-up power. The power that comes with being a bottom-up person is not hard power, it's soft power. It's about connecting to other people. It's about having empathy, compassion, kindness, caring. These are all bottom-up dimensions of being a human being. And, we have all these genes, literally hundreds of them, but genes don't automatically operate. There's this concept of epigenetics. The idea is you have a gene, but it may not express itself. And As an example, I talk about you take a redwood seed and you put a redwood seed in a cup of dry sand, nothing happens. Add water, you get a stunted little tree because there's no nutrients. Put that seed in a deep forest and it could grow to a 300-foot tree. Same genetics, different epigenetics. And I think that we have the potential as bottom-up beings to have an incredibly better, more connected, more connection-conscious world. And it's going to happen. I believe that. There are going to be revolutions. And the book has a whole chapter on revolutions and political change and how revolutions work. And with interviews from people who are experts on the different elements of that. There's a chapter on bottom-up economics and a chapter on bottom-up business. And what was really exciting, and I talked to Anne-Marie Slaughter. She was the policy director for the State Department. And she has a very bottom-up approach to diplomacy. And what was hopeful was I proposed it, and she agreed that if you start seeing the world with bottom-up eyes, even if you're using it as a top-down power, it starts to shift the way you do things. So even if top-down people like dictators start implementing bottom-up ideas, which is going to happen, then the people who are working for them are going to start seeing in bottom-up ways, and it's going to start affecting them. So I think we're going to return to a bottom-up way that we were before civilization. It's going to be a kind of a spiraling back to bottom-up and to a better way. And I'm very hopeful.
It's a very optimistic way of seeing the future, but I also think it's better than, I mean, in my opinion, it's better than cynicism, because usually that is an excuse to shut down and no longer remain connected or engage in the world. So I don't like that to usually be the last word, even if it's bleak. I like to find, you know, something to latch upon so that people can keep fighting and struggling however they may choose. I think that one thing you haven't talked about that would be a good way to conclude our conversation is to discuss what you've seen in the space of journalism and how bottom-up has impacted journalism. And I have my own experiences and you have yours, and I think this would be a good way to conclude is to have you share some of the success you've had with opednews.com and talking to other people and the way you think the space in media has been changed by this new way of thinking.
Okay, it has. Before the internet, before the ability to start a blog, start a website, to start a podcast, an online radio show, or a YouTube channel, you depended upon these massive, centralized, top-down, one-to-many news sites, TV shows, net channels. And that's changed. Now anybody can start a blog. I mean, I started Op-Ed News as a personal blog, and I started inviting people to write for me. And now we've published over 100,000 articles by thousands of people. And we literally publish about 500 articles a month. And if you're a writer, we'd love to have you submit to Op-Ed News. Just sign up as a member and submit your articles. It'll go into a queue. And one of the things that I experienced when I got, and one of the reasons I started Op-Ed News was I had been doing freelance writing, and I had written for national magazines and sold my work there. But it was using snail mail, and it could take a month or 2 months for the magazines to get back to me. But they did. Then I wrote an article for a progressive website, and they published it within 2 hours, and it blew my mind. I mean, that was really cool compared to the old snail mail way. But then I said, okay, I'll write another one, and I sent it in. I didn't hear anything from them, and I sent in another and another. I sent in 10 articles, and they never responded again. So I decided I can do this. I created my first website in 1995, And I decided to create a website, and I decided that anybody who submitted to me, I would respond to them. So, you know, we've done that. If you submit an article, even if we're not going to use it, we're going to let you know. We're going to let you know why. And so we do that. And I recruited a team of volunteer editors. And actually, because I didn't know about WordPress at the time, I built my own content management system that people have accused as being funded by the CIA, because it's a pretty good one. It's very powerful. But you know, the other one piece of it is Twitter. You know, if you're in working with news, you can find out very often faster from Twitter than you can from going to the TV or a newspaper or a news site what's going on, if you know how to use Twitter. And I talk about how to use Twitter prospectively. You know, a lot of people think about Twitter and Facebook as something where it depends on how many Facebook followers you have or friends you have or what have you. But there's a whole other bottom-up way of thinking about Twitter and Facebook, and that's a way to use it to find information. And I'm sure you know about that, Kev, because that's part of what you do. But so many people don't, and they just think, well, I only have 100 followers or 500 followers. I can't use Twitter. Twitter is an incredible tool in terms of doing search. And when you start using a bottom-up way of thinking about using Twitter and Facebook and Google, it changes things for you, and it gives you a heck of a lot more power and capability. And that, you know, like the story of the plane that landed in outside of Washington, outside of New York, in Hudson, I think it was, and they made a movie about the pilot because people lived through that. Well, the way that the news found out about it is somebody saw it and tweeted about it, and that's how it got started. And Twitter has become one of the most powerful ways to find out about news. That means that you don't have to have, you know, it used to be, and I literally was a writer in a newsroom back in 1979 where there was a teletype, and you would get stuff off of that finding out what the news was. You don't need that anymore. That's ancient technology. Now it's there for you to find just using the web and using Google Alerts and things like that. It's totally changed. And the reality is that the bottom-up revolution has given power to everybody in the world that before was only available to a very small number of elites. And it's only going to continue to explode. You know, you look at how 13-year-old kids can have YouTube channels with millions and millions of people. And the possibilities are endless. But it helps if you have a guidebook. And what I've tried to do with my book, The Bottom-Up Revolution, at robcall.com, is help people to start thinking in a more bottom-up way so they can see the possibilities.
All right, well, Rob, it was really great to talk to you. And, you know, once again, I just want to make sure people recognize that the kind of people who have endorsed your work are some of the people who I'm sure they come to shadowproof.com. They know of these people like Dave Zirin and John Kiriakou, who's a good friend. And
Bill McKibben.
And Bill McKibben.
Hartman did the intro to the book, Gar Alperovitz.
And Wendell Potter, who's been someone you've been talking to for a long time now on many of these issues and subjects. So, you know, this is a good bit of work. And so I think it's something that people should, they should take a look at, because it really could open your mind and consider some ideas that you never thought of before. So thanks for talking, Rob.
Thanks so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.